Welcome to the Humans Plus Tech podcast. I'm Amy Phillips, and this is Aaron Randall.
Hi.
Today, we're very excited to be talking to the one and only Chris Evans. So I first met Chris when he was working as a technical product manager and leading the platform team at Moo. He then went on to be the director for platform and reliability at Monzo before becoming co-founder and chief product officer at Incident.io. Chris is also a regular conference speaker and author of a number of articles about incident management and observability. So Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. And I need to pick you up on one thing straight away, which is you said the one and only Chris Evans, and there are literally two very famous Chris Evanses in the world. So you failed straight away, Amy.
I mean, clearly you are the more better known, I think.
Well, of course.
So great to have you here. Now, one of the things that, as you know, we like to do with all of our Humans Plus Tech guests is draw a doodle of them. So we're going to show you yours, and we'd love to get your thoughts on your doodle.
I'm actually really nervous. I'll take it. I like it.
I think, sound surprised.
Well, can I be honest about the thing that I think was stressing me out, which is that I sort of don't think I have any particularly distinguishing features. Like, you know, if you wear like certain shaped glasses or you've got something that's sort of like, yeah, that's the person. I think I'm actually quite bland looking. So I'll take it. And I really appreciate the little flame. It's cool. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we do struggle with this. Everyone looks like a sausage. So like we struggle to make, it's not you, it's everyone. It's my drawings, in fact.
Nice. Amazing. Thank you very much.
Great. Oh, hey, you're welcome. So I want to dive straight in and talk a bit more about the idea for Incident.io. So I know this idea came from an internal project you built whilst working at Monzo. And the project was called Response, an open source tool you built. How did Incident.io come about? And for those who haven't heard about it, what does Incident.io do?
Yeah, good question. I think I should probably like be very honest and credit the very, very early inception of like this kind of tooling to when Amy and I were at Moo. I think it was Ron who built the very, very first version here, which was like this super simple tool that used to create a channel for us when we had an incident. And it was like, poof, suddenly like we had a space to collaborate in, and it was like behind a slash command and was this magical thing. But yes, I guess like fast forwarding to a little bit to Monzo, I picked up, along with like running platform there, responsibility over the on-call team. And as part of that, I was sort of trying to make on-call an appealing thing for people to join. And part of the reason they weren't joining was because incidents were like quite painful, or quite chaotic. It was a bank. It was very stressful. You know, you could have like MasterCard not working and people couldn't make card payments. So wrote the very first version of the tooling there to basically just try and get some folks to join the on-call rotation and help out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then it went sort of from strength to strength within Monzo. So what started as something that sort of created a channel and then pinged out a notification to say, hey, an incident's happening, then sort of got more complex, and it started doing some more interesting things for us, like, you know, pinging data privacy folks when we were mentioning the word data breach, and sort of slowly sort of adding these various different like automations on top of the incident response. So, you know, nothing like crazy, like go and turn a server off or turn it on again, but just like process-y type things. And that was sort of then adopted across the whole of Monzo. And so Monzo went from a place where incidents sort of were things that happened in technology, and they happened, you know, once a month maybe, or once a week, you know, at worst. By the time I left Monzo, we were having something in the region of like 10 to 20 incidents a day. And that sounds incredibly scary. And I should sort of like point out that Monzo is not an unsafe place to put your money or doing anything wrong. What they'd done is like lowered the bar for incidents. So they'd made it the incidents were basically anything that was sort of, you know, not in the normal course of business. So, you know, it could be like a customer operations person posts something in a channel that they shouldn't have done, that sort of, you know, we had to delete a message and clean it up, or, you know, we rolled out a thing and had to roll it back. It was basically anything that needed to be like picked up that was reactive with some degree of urgency. And so this was sort of like the aha moment for us. And so Pete, Stephen, and myself, so like the founding team of Incident.io, started working on like an evenings and weekends project to turn what I'd written internally at Monzo into a a product that we thought could be, you know, saleable elsewhere. And, you know, it was like the pandemic was going on and it was like, cool, this is something fun to do. And then it sort of snowballed from there. And, you know, what was then an evenings and weekends project sort of became more and more of a sort of time consuming thing. We started selling to customers. And so there was sort of like regular late night or early morning calls to sort of sell this product, started making some traction. And then, yeah, the rest is sort of history. We've been growing ever since. And yeah, product's been getting better and better. It's really exciting.
Amazing. And what was that, you know, at what point did it dawn on you that this project was actually a company building opportunity? And also a follow-up question, I'd love to hear more about how that snowball sort of began to grow, I guess, from that evening and weekend project to something that customers are paying for.
Yeah, maybe it's a bit of an unfair reflection to say that it was an aha moment, because I don't think it wasn't. It wasn't sort of like, you know, we were in the lift one day and suddenly it was like, you know what, this is a thing. But I think it was more like, I think the three of us have all kind, you know, we've all worked in technology our whole careers. And for me, certainly, and I know it's very similar for Pete and Stephen, like I have dreamt of running a technology company or, you know, building something from the ground up. Like it's sort of like the dream situation for me to be able to not just about like working for myself, but to sort of just take something from nothing to something, you know. And we had pretty mild aspirations in those early days. We were sort of thinking of bootstrapping a thing and like just being like, well, this could be a good lifestyle business, never have to work again. But yeah, so it was more of a sort of a slow, like, hey, this is actually a thing. And it sort of, you know, came to that. And then I think when it came to like the snowballing thing, it was basically we launched the website when the product was in like, you know, incredible infancy. So it did the sort of basic things that Response did. That was Monzo's open source tool. It was a complete rewrite in different languages, but sort of did a similar thing of creating some channels, letting some folks know in a very, very basic web interface. But yeah, we put the website up and then had like immediately a bunch of sort of like posted on social media and like immediately had a bunch of inbound. And it was like that was kind of an aha moment, which is like, okay, cool. We've put a thing out, sort of like focused on the branding side of things. We bought a domain that was kind of cool. And there was just a lot of like traction from our network, basically, of people like, cool, we have a thing similar at our company that does this. Or, you know, we have a manual process written down on paper. And this looks great. Like it would help solve that. And so then it became a case of like starting to figure out how to sell, you know, SaaS software, you know, B2B, and like figure all that side of things out. And it kind of just picked up from there. And yeah, got first customers sort of paying, you know, a few hundred pounds here and there. And it was like, yeah, this is great. This is sort of something that's going to work.
Amazing. What were the sort of things that people, I suppose, like what were the problems that you were talking about on social media that people were jumping in and sort of saying, oh, we need that? Like, because I'm always surprised, like, you know, incident management has been around for a long time, but it's a long way away from being a solved problem. So what were the sort of things you saw that people were saying, like, these are the problems we're having, come help us?
Yeah, that's, I think that's a really interesting area, because incident management has been around for a long time. That's like my whole career, things like systems like PagerDuty have existed, OpsGenie, you know, various different software has existed to sort of help respond to things going wrong. But I think what our customers were seeing that was very different and where we were sort of going was that these software platforms were places you had to go to do things with incident response. So, you know, I got paged at 2 a.m., for example, and I wanted to go and get someone else. I'd have to go and jump back into PagerDuty to go and like make someone else's phone make a noise. But where I was coordinating my response was not on PagerDuty. I was in Slack, like most, you know, technology companies. And so you'd be sort of like the hub of everything going on in the incident is all founded on good communication, and the communication's happening in Slack. And you then had to go to PagerDuty to do a thing, or Jira to log that, you know, an incident was happening. And then you'd have a doc somewhere else off to the side, which was, you know, where you were tracking action items or who was doing what. And so that was the thing that really, really resonated. And sort of like, I think the message that we sort of landed on was that, you know, we'll meet you where you are. And we, you know, incidents are already really, really stressful. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be having like more cognitive load put on you. You want to be basically doing as effortless, you know, an effortless experience, doing as little as possible. And so, yeah, it was sort of like, hey, you're already in Slack. we'll come in, we'll augment that process for you, take a bunch of things off of your plate. If you need to use PagerDuty, you can do that through Slack as well. And you can get hold of the right people and, you know, keep context on what's going on. And the only time you should leave that channel is if you're actually going to wherever it is that something's going wrong. So to fix a system or, you know, jump into a terminal sort of thing.
I want to ask you a bit about that point you made about you always dreamt about building a tech company from the ground up. Tell us a little bit more about where the kind of the motivation for that came from and how long that had been an aspiration of yours.
Yeah, I think in university was where I first started thinking about it. And that was mainly motivated by a desire not to have to go and interview places. If I'm very honest, it was just like, hey, if I started a thing, no one can interview me. It's my sort of show.
Here you are now. It's not worked out at all.
No. What's happened? God damn it. I think fast forward a little bit. Like for me, I think I'm just very interested. I love building, clearly, right? So that's like the first thing. And so that has sort of been something I've been able to do most of my career one way or another with like technology. And I think doing that at a company is like the ultimate form of that. And I think like when I look at my career, when I sort of move from place to place, it has always been because I felt like I'd sort of like plateaued on like a learning sort of scale, if you like. So had an incredible time at Moo working with Amy. I'd say it's like one of my career highlights, you know. And what I did there was, what we did there was like do a massive, massive move of all of Moo's infrastructure from an on-premise data center into AWS. And then at the end of that journey, I sort of felt like it had plateaued a little bit and we were back into sort of steady state as a company of like, well, now we're here. How do we optimize and make things better? And, you know, interesting challenges, but I just sort of wanted to be pushed a bit harder. And so and for me, the next step was Monzo, which was then the, you know, do a similar thing to Moo, but on a bigger scale and in a company that's growing at some like astronomical rate. And then I think if you sort of extrapolate all of these kind of sort of situation, you then get to like building a company where it is just so hard. And the challenge, like I didn't go into it sort of thinking it would be easy. But I knew going into it that I would learn a lot about everything. And so it's really interesting now, like when we interview candidates and we do introductions and it's like, you know, I'll be like, oh, I'm Chris, I work at Incident IO, like CPO is my title here. But like really what I do is, and then I just list basically every function of the company. And it's like, yes, I'm like doing GTM, I'm doing sales, I'm doing marketing, I'm doing like all of these things. And it's both like equal parts terrifying, but also like just incredible as a learning experience. Like I genuinely don't think that there is a sort of more exciting and more sort of fully like multidisciplinary kind of challenge you can pick up than trying to build a company.
I want to ask a lot of questions about that. We've actually got a theme on that a little bit later, but before we move on to that, you know, this journey, this transition from Monzo to starting Instant IO and doing your own thing, and obviously with Instant IO you went down a VC route, making that transition out of Monzo, what did it mean to you to have the Monzo founders, you know, Tom and Jonas, invest in your new business?
Huge amount, absolutely huge amount. Like I think those folks supporting us was just massive, and they were so good through the whole process. So like we started building this company while we were at Monzo, and that was not something we did behind closed doors. Like Monzo has this you know, very much lived value of like defaulting to transparency. And so like early days we'd spoken to Jonas and been like, hey, I think by the letter of like our contracts, we're not supposed to, you know, if we start doing work on something during like Monzo, while we're working at Monzo, there's like a risk that you can, you know, you can take that off us kind of thing, or prevent us from doing that. And Jonas was like, absolutely not. Like might be in there, but like practically speaking, you have my word. This is fine for you to do. Was really encouraging. And so, yeah, they were just great through that whole process. They were great when it came to like raising our round, when we had to sort of get things from Monzo, you know, to say that this is definitely our IP and stuff like that. And then to have, yeah, Tom and Jonas basically backing you, two like heavy hitters when it comes to, you know, this kind of thing. They've built an incredible business out of Monzo, and it's just sort of, yeah, very buoying to sort of have those folks sort of feeling like they're willing to put, you know, their money where their mouth is and sort of actually, you know, give you that confidence.
It's awesome.
It's amazing. So I know it's still very early days, so it feels a little unfair to ask you this, but still, we can ask you again in a few years. But like, what have been your challenges so far? Like, what are the highs and lows in Incident IO's history so far?
Oh wow, that's it's like every day there are highs and lows. I'm trying to sort of pick which of these sort of things are.
You can like limit to a week if you want.
Yeah. I mean, like the highs, I'd say something that's like really, really been great for me is like selling the product now. And this is sort of like, I guess the context of where this comes from is, so back in the early days when we used to jump on sales calls and you jump on and like someone would be like, I want to see your product, and you'd be like, cool, well let's do a demo and we'll do this. I remember being literally terrified of these, like to the point where like for like 15 minutes before jumping on the call with them, I'd be like pacing up and down outside my office and sort of like cold sweats and that kind of thing. And then you jump onto the demo and I'd be like stressing because I'm trying to like drive, like showing them the product whilst talking, but also listening to them. And then they'd have objections and I'd be like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to say here, what I'm going to do. And so that was like genuinely a massive, massive struggle. And I think where it's now turned around is like literally one of my favorite things to do is to jump on a call with a customer and I can, you know, give the product pitch basically in my sleep. I can drive the product and like I'm so in, like basically at the core of it all, I love the domain. I'm passionate about the domain. I felt the problems. And so I sort of feel like I've got the cheat codes to selling to folks in so much as like I just sort of, you know, I can authentically speak about it basically. Mm-hmm. And so that's been, I would say, like a personal high of the company. Like more general highs for the company, some of the folks that we've managed to get as customers. So we have like some incredible customers and some, you know, well-recognized brands and things like that. And increasingly getting bigger companies coming to us who, you know, it sort of astonishes me that they are interested. And then it sort of doubly astonishes me that they see the product, they use it, and then we get incredibly, incredibly good feedback from them and they are buying it. So that's been amazing. Lows, what's a good low? I think lows for us are maybe some of the people that didn't work out. And I think this is like part of the harsh reality of startups is that they are very different to normal companies. And so, and you know, you hire someone and you're, you know, at the time you're like, well, our growth trajectory is like, you know, sort of this sort of not too steeper line. I realize I'm doing this on video and people can't see this. and then, you know, things change and your traction picks up more, which is a great problem to have. And then you realize that suddenly you're on a much, much steeper slope. And so some people who you hire maybe don't end up working out. And that's really hard because these are people, you're in such a small team and it feels, you know, very close and you go for dinner together and you're hustling on deals together. And so some people have not made it. And I think that's a really tough thing for us, but a sort of necessary part of keeping a high performance culture. And the great news is that folks who haven't sort of made it all the way through, they have left really amicably and it's sort of, you know, a mutual thing, which is really sort of, you know, the sort of small silver lining, I guess, on a bad situation.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned about being passionate about the domain. And I've got so many questions for you here. Chris and I have spent quite a lot of time, a lot of nights, I'd say, we've spent on incident calls. tell us a bit about incident management. Like, what does good incident management actually look like?
I think it's highly context dependent, which is like the ultimate like way to cop out and hedge before you answer a question. I appreciate, but I think it's dependent on like so many different factors. But I think at the core of it, like if you look at what an incident is, something bad has gone wrong, and there is some degree of urgency to get something fixed. And I think what makes incidents different to normal work is that urgency puts pressure on people. And I think that, you know, when incidents are certainly treated as the more severe things, what also happens is you end up sort of bringing together a bunch of people who don't normally work together. So, you know, in its simplest form, if you're a company that does anything with customers, then you're almost certainly going to be pulling together customer support folks and people who are dealing with whatever it is that's, you know, that's broken. And those two teams don't normally meet under normal circumstances. And so you've got like, this is the sort of like the core of it, which is, you know, something's gone wrong, lots of problems, people trying to form a team very, very quickly. And so I think that's quite a unique sort of space to be in, essentially. And so I think good incident management looks like having like systems in place that allow you to form that team really quickly, to, you know, set up some sort of like default rules of engagement and rails for how you'll coordinate that incident. Mm-hmm. And then essentially taking, you know, a bunch of things off your plate that, you know, that have to get done every time, and sort of trying to focus on like reducing cognitive burden so that you can focus on whatever it is that's going wrong at the time, basically. But like, I think at the core of all of this is just like very, very streamlined communication. That's really what these things come down to, because it's so hard to prepare anything for an incident. Like, you have people who have like playbooks for this and that, but they sort of are never going to survive contact with reality fully. And so it's all about, you know, being prepared to be unprepared, basically.
You run an earlier stage business, you know, a growing startup at early stage, and there are lots of those around as well. When's the right time for a business to, like a tech company or a tech team, to think about creating kind of this official on-call response policy and the firefighter regime, all these kind of things that go around incidents?
Yeah, I think on call is an interesting one as a sort of like side part of incident management. So I think on call, it's one of those things. I think when your business is dependent on you being available, that is, you know, and dependent meaning you cannot tolerate it being offline, that is your trigger for putting in an on-call practice. So, you know, if you're doing a social media site for cats, for example, probably in the early days when you've got 10 users, it doesn't matter if it breaks at 2 a.m. and you wake up at 8 and then fix it. I think as soon as customers are reliant upon something being sort of working, that's your trigger for having on call. That's your, you know, someone will always be available to support this thing. Sort of incident management, I'd sort of put it off slightly to the side, in so much as there's a lot you can do in the early days without overcomplicating things. And so, for example, I would not say that our software is a great fit if you are one team and you are under 10 people. Like, there is very little that can't be achieved with a bit of string and sellotape and, you know, a Slack channel where you communicate. I think as soon as you get to the point where, you know, either incidents are happening frequently, you've got multiple different teams who don't spend much time together, that's the sort of trigger for like, cool, well, it's helpful to have a process here. And there's obviously like a huge number of benefits off to the side of starting to have a more official incident management sort of procedure or way of dealing with things, in so much as once you, you know, if you're having things going wrong or you're being distracted by reactive work often enough, that is, you know, it's good to be able to track that work. And incidents are, if you know, if your policy is that we'll declare incidents for every sort of time that that happens, suddenly you get this visibility into your organization. And so this is something like, actually, we live and breathe incident.io. So we, touch wood, do not have incidents of like high severity. We have like, I could probably count on, you know, a few fingers how many times we've actually been offline or unavailable as an application. Mm-hmm. And when that's happened, we've been fortunate enough that we can sort of roll back or restart something and everything comes back. But what we do have is many, many times when little things go wrong, or we have like little errors in the app, and we treat every single one of those as an incident. So if a customer is like, hey, I tried to do this thing and it didn't work, we will treat that as an incident. And we now have incredible insight as to like, how much time are we spending not doing proactive kind of strategic work? And who's the person jumping into all of those incidents? And, you know, what's the impact like on those incidents? Like bad things, like small things? And suddenly you get this sort of like insight that you didn't previously have into your organization.
Mm. Oh, that's really amazing. What's the, like, for companies that aren't currently doing that, like, what's the correct way to start looking for those patterns so that, you know, it doesn't feel like blamey that like this person did 10 incidents and this other person just did one, or, you know, this person broke this server 3 times last week? Like, how do you actually gather that insight from incidents in a healthy way?
Yeah, I think like this is like a topic that I am incredibly passionate about, is the sort of KPIing and over metricing incidents. So I think like my advice would be to essentially steer clear of any top line number around incidents. So there's a really common one that gets thrown around a lot, which we have sort of begrudgingly added to our app, primarily because like customers are like, I need this thing, and that's MTTR, which is mean time to recovery. And the sort of the theory behind this is that you go, oh, well, for every incident, I will measure the time from when we sort of deemed it to be the start to deemed it to be over. And then we'll just average that across everything. And we want that to, you know, trend down or at least not trend up. And like there's various like sort of papers been written about the actual, like how this is just not an effective thing and is very misleading. And at the core of it, it's just like, it's kind of ridiculous when you think about it. It's like, People are not going to take any longer than they sort of need to in incidents, and no one's choosing when an incident happens. And incidents almost certainly by their very nature are sort of things that no one can predict. And so it sort of just is basically meaningless. And so I'd say the same is true as of anyone who's trying to sort of go, well, Amy had 10 incidents that she reported. I would be like, that's great. You are all over it. And like I've written blog posts for Incident.io, which are like why more incidents is a great thing for an organization and you should encourage that. And so, yeah, I guess my like overarching advice around like numbers and using incidents for insights is if you really must use a number because it's the kind of the way that you can sort of your entry point, I guess, into looking at something, by all means, but you know, you need to go that level deeper, which is like, even if you are addicted to MTTR, when that trends upwards, the first step is not like throw your toys out the pram and table flip. It's like, cool, this is a starting point for an investigation. And it might be that investigation leads you down to, cool, everything's absolutely fine. We've actually just, you know, changed something with our infrastructure. And that's like, you know, you see what I mean? Like, it's just like basically meaningless to treat numbers around this stuff.
One of the things that I've experienced and observed, I guess, firsthand with the tech teams I've worked in is around incidents is particularly for newer members of the team that are less experienced with the stack and with the technology you're working with, how stressful responding to incidents is, like how stressful it is joining the firefighting rota for the first time or responding to incidents and being the person on call for the first time. How have you thought about that when you're building Incident.io and like and try to support make it a better dev experience in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few different angles here. So I think the first one is that by dealing with incidents like transparently out in the open and lowering the severity, like folks who are looking to ramp up have an incredible like back catalog of, you know, this is how these people deal with incidents. And so the things that we encourage and that I sort of picked up from someone who I used to work with called Sahail at Monzo. So he used to do incidents and he'd sort of go off on an incident by himself. And it was fine because it was like a low severity thing. And he ended up using these like incident channels as like debug trails. And so he would just be like talking out loud in a channel. So he's like, oh, I've seen this thing. That's really curious. I'm kind of a bit surprised by that. Here's like the output of my terminal at this window. I'm going to go look at this now. And he'd do this whole thing. And so I do that a lot. So I'm on call at Incident.io. When things go wrong, like I will create an incident channel and I will just leave my debug trail. And that has like a number of different benefits. Like the first of which, like if you need to call on anyone else to come and join, you've got this like, cool, you can catch up in the channel. All the context is there. But as I said, for an onboarding tool, it's incredible for folks to be able to like browse those things and you can walk through old incidents and, you know, go to debriefs. That's like a fantastic way to learn. But I think then another angle, which is really, really useful, which is when folks are ready to sort of like take that first step into being the person who is paged or first responding to an incident, is to just do it in hours and do it for low severity things. And you can basically go, cool, well, either you take it yourself or you can reverse shadow. So we pull in someone else. And so we have ways of doing that with Incident.io. So you can configure the product to basically run these lightweight automations, which would be like, cool, if an incident's declared and it's minor, automatically pull in Lawrence and he will be there to sort of help shadow you through this process. And so that I think is another really, really good way to level folks up. And then the sort of, I guess, future direction for us is like we would love to build something that is like a better version of PagerDuty. PagerDuty makes it incredibly difficult for folks to shadow people. Like I have spent countless hours at previous companies trying to get like schedules to work and escalation policies so that I can have two people on call at a given time.
Yeah, I've battled all this stuff, yeah.
It's just so frustrating. It feels like such a basic thing that you want to do as a sort of engineering leader is set this sort of like healthy onboarding rotation up, and you have to sort of hack it. And so in the future, we'll be very much focused on that. I think like the general point here is like, we are like the three of us who founded this company have all been sort of like engineering leaders in one shape or another and have seen these sort of pain points time and time again, and sort of building tools for humans is very much like front and center of what we're trying to achieve.
I love that idea as well of, as you described, like going through this like process of like posting your terminal screenshots and like talking to yourself sounds like an absolute treasure trove of information for other people, like to come and see this trail of information you've left for them. That's amazing.
It's fascinating. It can be yeah. really enlightening, and it's like genuinely such a good way to learn, because you'll see people who post things, you'll be like, oh my gosh, I didn't know you could get that data from that system like that. And it's like, that's honestly, that's one of the biggest like superpowers, I think, of incidents, is like this concept of tacit knowledge, which is like that knowledge that people just know. And it's sort of tribal knowledge among organizations. And it's really dangerous because people leave and they take that with them, and people can't make good decisions if they don't have all of the information. And so, yeah, the more that you can bring out to the fore, the better. And in fact, this reminds me, like my favorite feature of our product is this really, really like small thing that we built in like an evening, because we sort of had a little bit of capacity left at the end of a week, which is at the end of your incident, we will prompt with a little button which says, how did this incident go? Leave some feedback. And we see customers use this again and again and again. You'll have folks will be like, oh, I literally didn't know how Amy found that dashboard. I didn't know that existed, but it was like super useful for finding the way here. And it sort of snowballs, and people will just leave all of this feedback. And it's just like, you can just see like this torrent of tacit knowledge like pouring down. And it's just, yeah, a fascinating thing to be able to see, basically.
That's awesome.
How incredible. So we've talked a little bit around this stuff, but super keen to hear, Chris, kind of how you've ended up in this place, right? So you've gone through lots of changes in your career. Starting out as a software engineer, you've been technical product manager, technical director, now co-founder, chief product officer. So what are kind of some of the biggest learnings that you've got from this journey and sort of transitioning through these roles?
Wow. Oh, man. That's a big question. What have I learned?
What about some of these big transitions, right? So like, I'm particularly interested, I suppose, how did you move from software engineering into product management? Because that feels like, I think it's a popular route, but I don't think it's a common route. Like, you know, I think people like the look of it, but I don't think that many people actually make that transition. How did you go about doing that? And what were kind of some of the surprises when you did make that move?
Yeah, that is a good question. And one I have a good answer for, which was that, so I spent like 7 years as a software engineer at a small company that was developing these like infrared sensors. And I was originally writing like embedded code for them, and then later writing like the applications, like web apps that supported them. And won't go into like loads of the details there, but basically at the end of my time there, I ended up like flying like various places around the world to go and like sell our product. And we were selling products to supermarkets primarily. It was like counting people in queues and through doors and stuff. And I think for me, I realized that at that point, like my impact could be greater, not as an individual contributor, but as someone who could kind of go and be a bridge between non-technical folks and then engineers who were writing software. And yeah, I think I carved out a little bit of a niche there in some organizations, which was that essentially that translation from, you know, people doing the work on the ground through to, you know, whether it's managers or customers or anyone outside, I think it's quite rare to find that done in a good way. And I think there's a lot of sort of like benefit of having that communication streamlined both ways. And so that was what led me into technical product management, which was just, you know, How can I help in the way that I think I'm sort of most impactful? And as it happens, the first jump into technical product management was absolute carnage for me. And it was like working at Marks and Spencer's in like an enormous IT organization with my entire team out in India, And whilst they were great, like just all the communication barriers and the like, you know, time zone overlaps and all those sorts of things, it was kind of dreadful, and I felt pretty ineffective there. And then when I sort of made the move to Moo that I think it was right. It really clicked for me, which was like big organization wide project to do this whole data center. Basically, I remember just like the team that we were in sort of felt a little bit like the rock stars of the company, because that we've been told like
incredible this is... team as well, like shout out, because
yeah,
probably all listening, I expect.
Well, yeah, this is the thing. So I remember joining and just being like astonished at the level of talent that Moo had like been able to hire. So we had some like just incredible like platform engineers. And and then combined with that, like Mary Williams, who I think has been on this podcast before, was CTO. And so she was able to basically, I mean, she basically was like, this is the most important thing for Moo. And really, really repeatedly backed that up and gave like all the resources that we needed, whether that was time or money or additional people or additional weight across, you know, exec team or other teams. I think basically to summarize, Moo is where I really clicked and was like, yes, this is definitely for me. I really enjoy this whole, you know, one foot in like technical camp and able to sort of help, or at least, you know, help make decisions or, you know, influence those sorts of things. And then the other side of like helping to, you know, make sure that everyone understood what was going on and that we were doing things on the right timelines, et cetera, et cetera. I think like the, as I said earlier, like the sort of extrapolation of all of this is then being someone who then, you know, I now have like a foot in the engineering camp, a foot in marketing camp, and a foot in various different camps around the company that I'm in now. And then my sort of stakeholders, for want of a better phrase, are investors and the many, many customers and like the other co-founders that I work with. And so, yeah, I think I just found out that those are the things that I really enjoy. And I think I'm good at, or at least I haven't managed to like crash and burn this company yet. So far, so good.
You mentioned earlier in this discussion about building a company, you use the phrase, it was so hard to build a company. And also around the co-founder role, that it's like a truly multidisciplinary role. You know, you mentioned doing GTM plus product plus tech plus everything. How did you find that transition from being an employee at Monzo to like running and co-founding a business at Instant.io?
Yeah, I remember talking to Jonas, the CTO at Monzo before I left, and him just sort of like a friendly warning. He was like, this will be like nothing you've ever done before. I can't remember the exact words, but it was just like, you know, go in eyes open. And I was like, yeah, I got this. This is fine. But I think the transition was actually eased by the fact that I had Pete and Steven around. Mm-hmm. So we often talk about how, I mean, firstly, just massively grateful we are to be a founding team of three people, and three people who get on incredibly well. And it's been now, you know, a year and a half and whatever, and we haven't had any significant fallouts, which is very nice. But we often talk about like having out of phase, like sine waves of, you know, when one person's down, it's almost guaranteed that you're not going to have both, you know, let the other two not be up, or at least, you know, out of phase in some way. And so that, it's been like incredibly hard starting this company and so much to do, but we are a tight knit group and very, very supportive. And so it sort of doesn't feel like I've sort of had to face, you know, build a sales org and be like, I have no idea how to do that. It's like, cool, well, let's all go and figure this out and we'll come back and we'll regroup and we'll work together on, you know, a master sales deck and we'll figure out how we do this and that. And like, what does marketing look like? And yeah, so I think it's sort of, it's just hard. And I think it takes a certain type of sort of run through walls mentality to do it well, which is, you know, you've got to be the kind of person that sees a big problem as an opportunity rather than something to kind of like, you know, run away from. And it's hard, like that's not an easy thing to do, but I think you sort of just, I don't know. I think something I've developed later in my career actually is just this kind of like attitude of saying yes to things, even if I don't believe it. And like, this is how I got into like speaking at conferences. And it was just like someone asks you and says, you know, will you do that? Or will you talk at this meetup? And I just sort of was like, yes. And then I stressed for about 3 months and then progressively. In fact, I think it was someone Amy and I used to work with at Moo, a guy, Mike Harris, who used to I think he described giving conference talks as like reverse hangovers, where you get more and more and more sort of ill feeling towards the event, and then it happens, and then it's like it's all good again, kind of thing.
Which, like the pit of despair, like 3 days before when you realize you've really got to write that talk, and you have deep regrets. Yes. And then on the day, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
And afterwards, it's even better. And then you sign up for the next one.
Exactly. And you, in the build up to the talk, you'll be like, never again. Why did I do this? And then it's that, like, I think the thing that I can't remember who said it, I can't remember where I heard it, but the thing I love about like conference talking is like, I'm a massive introvert. And when I go to a conference, I really struggle to go and like just strike up conversation with people around a conference. But if you talk at a conference, people want to just come and talk to you. And it's just like, that's brilliant. I love that. Cause I genuinely enjoy talking to people. I just like, it's that like awkward intro thing, which I think generally British people are just dreadful at. and me, especially so.
I love that.
Fantastic. One thing that's always struck me, Chris, is you have remained very technical and you've always been quite hands-on. And even sort of like when we worked together at Moo and you were sort of like, I know you were a technical product manager, but like, you know, you were very much experimenting with things and I saw this thing and I've tried this thing out. Like how have you managed to stay so in touch with technology as you've gone through all these different roles?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably a stretch to say I'm really in touch with technology. Like I think in the back of my mind, ever since I stopped sort of writing code as a full-time gig, has been that sort of fear of waking up one day and being in a meeting that in a technology company and someone says something or there's a conversation going on and you just being like, I literally have no idea what's going on. And I remember this at like at M&S, and like, I don't want to sort of talk ill of previous employer, but there were people there who just didn't get the modern world. They just sort of like in IT orgs and it's sort of like just seeing out a career. And that has always been in the back of my mind, is like, I just don't want to be that person. And as I said earlier, like the sort of niche that I feel like I've carved out is this sort of conduit, I guess, for want of a better phrase, between technology people, engineering people, folks on the sharp edge of doing this work and people outside of that. And I think something else that sort of like is like a barometer for how I'm doing is, can I go to a sort of a meeting with someone and not have to bring an engineer along to sort of like translate or, you know, be support or anything else like that. So I think those things have always factored into my mind. And then like, as to how practically I have sort of, I think, stayed in touch with that technology is like, at my heart, I'm like a massive nerd. And so I see things and like, for me, it is like the solution is just write some software. And so I haven't stopped writing software in sort of some capacity at all in my whether it's like hacking a Raspberry Pi around to like control the lights in my house or, you know, writing some like open source software over a weekend. I think just being curious and keeping your hand in is sort of the way that stayed about. But I don't know. I feel like I've sort of seen the future of where I might draw the line on where my sort of knowledge is. And I think it's crypto, in that it's sort of like, I see things and I'm like, I don't understand any of those words. And I also have like precisely no desire to go and figure it out either. I'm just like, is this what my like grandparents thought of email? And they were just like, it's never going to catch on. Don't worry about it, kind of thing.
Definitely that. And I feel the same as you as well, but it's worth it. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. But before we let you go, as with all of our Humans Plus Tech guests, we have four quick fire questions we'd like to ask everyone. So I'm going to send these your way very quickly. Let's get your rapid responses. So first question is, what's your top book recommendation?
It's going to be really, really, oh no, it's not lame. The Field Guide to Understanding Human Error by Sydney Decker. Absolute belter.
Interesting. I've never heard of it. Amy, you're nodding your head.
I've never heard of it either. I've never read it. I've never heard of it. And nobody has ever recommended it before. So
I was about to go Harry Potter.
So if you recommend a book that Amy hasn't heard of, she's my sort of litmus test for it's worth reading or not, because she's read everything. So this is you've broken that rule. Okay, great. Question number two. What or who is your number one tip for keeping up with the industry?
Former guest on this show, Kelsey Hightower. Absolutely love the guy.
Legend. He's incredible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great. I mean, related question, but question number three, who inspires you in tech?
Can I cheat and say Kelsey Hightower again?
Who else inspires you in tech?
Who else inspires me in tech? Frank Slootman, I think his name is, the former CEO of ServiceNow and now working at Snowflake. I think he is a very interesting guy, written a bunch of books, worth checking out. And he's been on a bunch of podcasts too.
Amazing. Great. And the final question of the four quick fires, what's the most ridiculous thing about you?
Oh gosh, what's ridiculous about me? I don't know. Can I cheat and ask for what other people have said is ridiculous about them? Or Amy, you know me. What's ridiculous about me?
We can give you an alternate question, actually, which might be more themed. Tell us about your favorite incident, nightmare story.
Oh, I can do that. Yeah, so I like had my fair share of incidents over my time. I think the very, very worst one that I had is one that I wrote a public postmortem for at Monzo, which was where we were scaling up our database, which was an incredibly routine operation that we had planned for and we had run through in like pre-prod environments and done a lot of work for. And when we went to production, it all went to shit and we broke a lot of things for a lot of people and took an entire bank offline. Turned out to be a single like Boolean flag that was true and should have been false. And so lots of pain ensued. And I wrote a detail about it, so I won't go too far into it right now, but I'm sort of getting the cold sweats. Just
yeah, I was going to say, I'm getting sweaty palms and I wasn't even there. Wow. I mean, a great thing to live through. Well done for getting out the other side.
Yeah.
Amazing. And finally, where can people find out more about you?
I guess either for me personally, follow me on Twitter. I have a ridiculous handle that you can't pronounce, but it's like EVNSIO or incident.io. That's a good place to go and find more.
Amazing. Great. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. Learned a bunch and loved hearing your stories. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
We'll be sharing all the links and show notes, plus the all-important doodle over on humansplus.tech. I'm Aaron Randall. This is Amy Phillips, and you've been listening to the Humans Plus Tech podcast.